kind of inquisition. Here the communists were in power, and they criticized his plays as decadent and pessimistic. He didn't argue with them, but made small changes in the performance scripts to shut them up. Meanwhile, he managed to preserve the published texts as written. His outward conformity in both cases gave him the freedom to work unhindered, without having to change his thinking. In the end, he made his way safely through dangerous times in different countries through the use of little dances of orthodoxy, and proved he was more powerful than the forces of repression. Not only do people of power avoid the offenses of Pausanias and Sauk, they also learn to play the clever fox and feign the common touch. This has been the ploy of con artists and politicians throughout the centuries. Leaders like Julius Caesar and Franklin D. Roosevelt have overcome their natural aristocratic stance to cultivate a familiarity with the common man. They have expressed this familiarity in little gestures, often symbolic, to show the people that their leaders share popular values, despite their different status. The logical extension of this practice is the invaluable ability to be all things to all people. When you go into society, leave behind your own ideas and values, and put on the mask that is most appropriate for the group in which you find yourself. Bismarck played this game successfully for years. There were people who vaguely understood what he was up to, but not clearly enough that it mattered. People will swallow the bait because it flatters them to believe that you share their ideas. They will not take you as a hypocrite if you're careful. For how can they accuse you of hypocrisy if you don't let them know exactly what you stand for? Nor will they see you as lacking in values. Of course you have values, the values you share with them while in their company. Reversal. The only time it is worth standing out is when you already stand out, when you have achieved an unshakable position of power and can display your difference from others as a sign of the distance between you. As President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson would sometimes hold meetings while he sat on the toilet. Since no one else either could or would claim such a privilege, Johnson was showing people that he didn't have to observe the protocols and niceties of others. The Roman Emperor Caligula played the same game. He would wear a woman's negligee or a bathrobe to receive important visitors. He even went so far as to have his horse elected consul. But it backfired, for the people hated Caligula, and his gestures eventually brought his overthrow. The truth is that even those who attain the heights of power would be better off at least affecting the common touch, for at some point they may need popular support. Finally, there is always a place for the gadfly, the person who successfully defies custom and mocks what has grown lifeless in a culture. Oscar Wilde, for example, achieved considerable social power on this foundation. He made it clear that he disdained the usual ways of doing things, and when he gave public readings, his audiences not only expected him to insult them, but welcomed it. We notice, however, that his eccentric role eventually destroyed him. Even had he come to a better end, remember that he possessed an unusual genius. Without his gift to amuse and delight, his barbs would simply have offended people. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Balthazar Gracian. Think with the few and speak with the many. It is easy to run into danger by trying to swim against the stream. Only a Socrates could attempt to do that. Disagreement is regarded as offensive because it is a condemnation of the views of others. The numbers of the disgruntled grow on account either of some matter that has been the object of censure or of some person who has praised it. Truth is for the few. Error is as usual as it is vulgar. Nor is the wise man to be recognized by what he says in the marketplace, for he speaks there not with his own voice, but with that of universal folly, however much his inmost thoughts may gainsay it. The wise man avoids being contradicted as sedulously as he avoids contradicting. The publicity of censure is withheld from that which readily provokes it. Thought is free. It cannot and should not be coerced. Retire into the sanctuary of your silence, and if you sometimes allow yourself to break it, do so under the aegis of a discreet few. From Ovid, he lives well who conceals himself well. from Sir Walter Raleigh. Wise men should be like coffers with double bottoms, which when others look into being opened, they see not all that they hold. From the Tales of the Dervishes, Idris Shah. When the Waters Were Changed. Once upon a time, Khidr, the teacher of Moses, called upon mankind with a warning. At a certain date, he said, all the water in the world, which had not been specially hoarded, would disappear. It would then be renewed with different water, which would drive men mad. Only one man listened to the meaning of this advice. He collected water and went to a secure place where he stored it, and waited for the water to change its character. On the appointed date, the streams stopped running, the wells went dry, and the man who had listened, seeing this happening, went to his retreat and drank his preserved water. When he saw, from his security, the waterfalls again beginning to flow, this man descended among the other sons of men. He found that they were thinking and talking in an entirely different way from before. Yet they had no memory of what had happened, nor of having been warned. When he tried to talk to them, he realized that they thought that he was mad, and they showed hostility or compassion, not understanding. At first he drank none of the new water, but went back to his concealment to draw on his supplies every day. Finally, however, he took the decision to drink the new water, because he could not bear the loneliness of living, behaving, and thinking in a different way from everyone else. He drank the new water and became like the rest. Then he forgot all about his own store of special water, and his fellows began to look upon him as a madman who had miraculously been restored to sanity. From Arthur Schopenhauer. Never combat any man's opinion. For though you reach the age of Methuselah, you would never have done setting him right upon all the absurd things that he believes. It is also well to avoid correcting people's mistakes in conversation, however good your intentions may be, for it is easy to offend people and difficult, if not impossible, to mend them. If you feel irritated by the absurd remarks of two people whose conversation you happen to overhear, you should imagine that you are listening to the dialogue of two fools in a comedy. Probatum est. The man who comes into the world with the notion that he is really going to instruct it in matters of the highest importance may thank his stars if he escapes with a whole skin. From Fables by Robert Louis Stevenson. The Citizen and the Traveler.
Look around you, said the citizen. This is the largest market in the world.
Oh, surely not, said the traveler.
Well, perhaps not the largest, said the citizen, but much the best.
You are certainly wrong there, said the traveler. I can tell you... They buried the stranger in the dusk. And from Voltaire. If Machiavelli had had a prince for a disciple, the first thing he would have recommended him to do would have been to write a book against Machiavellism.
The 39th Law. Stir up waters to catch fish.
Judgment. Anger and emotion are strategically counterproductive. You must always stay calm and objective. But if you can make your enemies angry while staying calm yourself, you gain a decided advantage. Put your enemies off balance. Find the chink in their vanity through which you can rattle them and you hold the strings.
Transgression of the law. In January of 1809, an agitated and anxious Napoleon hurried back to Paris from his Spanish wars. His spies and confidants had confirmed a rumor that his foreign minister, Talleyrand, had conspired against him with Fouché, the minister of police. Immediately on arriving in the capital, the shocked emperor summoned his ministers to the palace. Following them into the meeting right after their arrival, he began pacing up and down, and started rambling vaguely about plotters working against him, speculators bringing down the stock market, legislators delaying his policies, and his own ministers undermining him. As Napoleon talked, Talleyrand leaned on the mantelpiece, looking completely indifferent. Facing Talleyrand directly, Napoleon announced, "For these ministers, treason has begun when they permit themselves to doubt.
At the word treason, the ruler expected his minister to be afraid. But Talleyrand only smiled, calm and bored. The sight of a subordinate apparently serene in the face of the charges that could get him hanged pushed Napoleon to the edge. "There were ministers," he said, "who wanted him dead." And he took a step closer to Talleyrand, who stared back at him unfazed. Finally, Napoleon exploded. "You are a coward," he screamed in Talleyrand's face. "A man of no faith. Nothing is sacred to you. You would sell your own father. I have showered you with riches, and yet there is nothing you would not do to hurt me." The other ministers looked at each other in disbelief. They had never seen this fearless general, the conqueror of most of Europe, so unhinged. "You deserve to be broken like glass," Napoleon continued, stamping. "I have the power to do it, but I have too much contempt for you to bother. Why didn't I have you hang from the gates of the Tuileries? But there is still time for that." Yelling, almost out of breath, his face red, his eyes bulging, he went on. "You, by the way, are nothing but shit in a silk stocking. What about your wife? You never told me that San Carlos was your wife's lover."
"Indeed, sire, it did not occur to me that this information had any bearing on your majesty's glory or my own," said Talleyrand calmly, completely unflustered. After a few more insults, Napoleon walked away. Talleyrand slowly crossed the room, moving with his characteristic limp. As an attendant helped him with his cloak, he turned to his fellow ministers, all afraid they would never see him again, and said, "What a pity, gentlemen, that so great a man should have such bad manners." Despite his anger, Napoleon did not arrest his foreign minister. He merely relieved him of his duties and banished him from the court, believing that for this man humiliation would be punishment enough. He did not realize that word had quickly spread of his tirade, of how the emperor had completely lost control of himself, and how Talleyrand had essentially humiliated him by maintaining his composure and dignity. A page had been turned. For the first time, people had seen the great emperor lose his cool under fire. A feeling spread that he was on the way down. As Talleyrand later said, "This is the beginning of the end." Interpretation. This was indeed the beginning of the end. Waterloo was still 6 years ahead, but Napoleon was on a slow descent to defeat, crystallizing in 1812 with his disastrous invasion of Russia. Talleyrand was the first to see the signs of his decline, especially in the irrational war with Spain. Sometime in 1808, the minister decided that for the future peace of Europe, Napoleon had to go. And so he conspired with Fouché. It is possible that the conspiracy was never anything more than a ploy, a device to push Napoleon over the edge. For it is hard to believe that two of the most practical men in history would only go halfway in their plotting. They may have been only stirring the waters, trying to goad Napoleon into a misstep. And indeed what they got was the tantrum that laid out his loss of control for all to see. In fact, Napoleon's soon famous blow-up that afternoon had a profoundly negative effect on his public image. This is the problem with the angry response. At first it may strike fear and terror, but only in some. And as the days pass and the storm clears, other responses emerge. Embarrassment and uneasiness about the shouter's capacity for going out of control, and resentment of what has been said. Losing your temper, you always make unfair and exaggerated accusations. A few such tirades, and people are counting the days until you're gone. In the face of a conspiracy against him, a conspiracy between his two most important ministers, Napoleon certainly had a right to feel angry and anxious. But by responding so angrily and so publicly, he only demonstrated his frustration. To show your frustration is to show that you have lost your power to shape events. It is the helpless action of the child who resorts to a hysterical fit to get his way. The powerful never reveal this kind of weakness. There were a number of things Napoleon could have done in this situation. He could have thought about the fact that two eminently sensible men had had reason to turn against him, and could have listened and learned from them. He could have tried to win them back to him. He could even have gotten rid of them, making their imprisonment or death an ominous display of his power. No tirades, no childish fits, no embarrassing after-effects, just a quiet and definitive severing of ties. Remember, tantrums neither intimidate nor inspire loyalty. They only create doubts and uneasiness about your power. Exposing your weakness, these stormy eruptions often herald a fall.
Observance of the law. By the late 1920s, Haile Selassie had nearly achieved his goal of assuming total control over Ethiopia, a country he felt needed strong and unified leadership. As regent of the Empress Zauditu, stepdaughter of the late queen and heir to the throne, Selassie had spent several years weakening the power of Ethiopia's various warlords. Now only one real obstacle stood in his way, the Empress and her husband Ras Gugsa. Selassie knew the royal couple hated him and wanted to get rid of him. So to cut short their plotting, he made Gugsa the governor of the northern province of Begemeder, forcing him to leave the capital where the Empress lived. For several years, Gugsa played the loyal administrator. But Selassie didn't trust him. He knew that Gugsa and the Empress were plotting revenge. As time passed and Gugsa made no move, the chances of a plot only increased. Selassie knew what he had to do. Draw Gugsa out, get under his skin, and push him into action before he was ready. For several years, a northern tribe, the Azebu Gala, had been in virtual rebellion against the throne, robbing and pillaging local villages and refusing to pay taxes. Selassie had done nothing to stop them, letting them grow stronger. Finally, in 1929, he ordered Ras Gugsa to lead an army against these disobedient tribesmen. Gugsa agreed, but inwardly he seethed. He had no grudge against the Azebu Gala, and the demand that he fight them hurt his pride. He could not disobey the order, but as he worked to put together an army, he began to spread an ugly rumor that Selassie was in cahoots with the Pope and planned to convert the country to Roman Catholicism and make it a colony of Italy. Gugsa's army swelled, and some of the tribes from which its soldiers came secretly agreed to fight Selassie. In March of 1930, an enormous force of 35,000 men began to march, not on the Azebu Gala, but south toward the capital of Addis Ababa. Made confident by his growing strength, Gugsa now openly led a holy war to depose Selassie and put the country back in the hands of true Christians. He did not see the trap that had been laid for him. Before Selassie had ordered Gugsa to fight the Azebu Gala, he had secured the support of the Ethiopian church. And before the revolt got underway, he had bribed several of Gugsa's key allies not to show up for battle. As the rebel army marched south, airplanes flew overhead dropping leaflets, announcing that the highest church officials had recognized Selassie as the true Christian leader of Ethiopia, and that they had excommunicated Gugsa for fomenting a civil war. These leaflets severely blunted the emotions behind the Holy Crusade, and as battle loomed and the support that Gugsa's allies had promised him failed to show up, soldiers began to flee or defect. When the battle came, the rebel army quickly collapsed. Refusing to surrender, Ras Gugsa was killed in the fighting. The Empress, distraught over her husband's death, died a few days later. On April 30th, Selassie issued a formal proclamation announcing his new title, Emperor of Ethiopia. Interpretation. Haile Selassie always saw several moves ahead. He knew that if he let Ras Gugsa decide the time and place of the revolt, the danger would be much greater than if he forced Gugsa to act on Selassie's terms. So he goaded him into rebellion by offending his manly pride, asking him to fight people he had no quarrel with, on behalf of a man he hated. Thinking everything out ahead, Selassie made sure that Gugsa's rebellion would come to nothing, and that he could use it to do away with his last two enemies. This is the essence of the law. When the waters are still, your opponents have the time and space to plot actions that they will initiate and control. So stir the waters, force the fish to the surface, get them to act before they're ready. Steal the initiative. The best way to do this is to play on uncontrollable emotions, pride, vanity, love, hate. Once the water is stirred up, the little fish cannot help but rise to the bait.
The angrier they become, the less control they have. And finally, they are caught in the whirlpool you have made, and they drown. As Sun Tzu said, a sovereign should never launch an army out of anger. A leader should never start a war out of wrath. Keys to power. Angry people usually end up looking ridiculous, for the response seems out of proportion to what occasioned it. They have taken things too seriously, exaggerating the hurt or insult that has been done to them. They are so sensitive to slight that it becomes comical how much they take personally. More comical still is their belief that their outbursts signify power. The truth is the opposite. Petulance is not power. It is a sign of helplessness. People may temporarily be cowed by your tantrums, but in the end they lose respect for you. They also realize they can easily undermine a person with so little self-control. The answer, however, is not to repress our anger or emotional responses, for repression drains us of energy and pushes us into strange behavior. Instead, we have to change our perspective. We have to realize that nothing in the social realm and in the game of power is personal. Everyone is caught up in a chain of events that long predates the present moment. Our anger often stems from problems in our childhood, from the problems of our parents, which stem from their own childhood, on and on. Our anger also has roots in the many interactions with others, the accumulated disappointments and heartaches that we have suffered. An individual will often appear as the instigator of our anger, but it is much more complicated, goes far beyond what that individual did to us. If a person explodes with anger at you, and it seems out of proportion to what you did to them, you must remind yourself that it is not exclusively directed at you. Do not be so vain. The cause is much larger, goes way back in time, involves dozens of prior hurts, and is actually not worth the bother to understand. Instead of seeing it as a personal grudge, look at the emotional outburst as a disguised power move, an attempt to control or punish you cloaked in the form of hurt feelings and anger. This shift of perspective will let you play the game of power with more clarity and energy. Instead of overreacting and becoming ensnared in people's emotions, you will turn their loss of control to your advantage. You keep your head while they are losing theirs. During an important battle in the War of the Three Kingdoms in the 3rd century A.D., advisors to the commander Cao Cao discovered documents showing that certain of his generals had conspired with the enemy and urged him to arrest and execute them. Instead, he ordered the documents burned and the matter forgotten. At this critical moment in the battle, to get upset or demand justice would have reverberated against him. An angry action would have called attention to the general's disloyalty, which would have harmed the troops' morale. Justice could wait. He would deal with the generals in time. Cao Cao kept his head and made the right decision. Compare this to Napoleon's response to Talleyrand. Instead of taking the conspiracy personally, the emperor should have played the game like Cao Cao, carefully weighing the consequences of any action he took. The more powerful response in the end would have been to ignore Talleyrand, or to bring the minister gradually back to his side and punish him later. Anger only cuts off our options, and the powerful cannot thrive without options. Once you train yourself not to take matters personally and to control your emotional responses, you will have placed yourself in a position of tremendous power. Now you can play with the emotional responses of other people. Stir the insecure into action by impugning their manhood and by dangling the prospect of an easy victory before their faces. Do as Houdini did when challenged by the less successful escape artist Clepini. Reveal an apparent weakness. Houdini let Clepini steal the combination for a pair of cuffs to lure your opponent into action. Then you can beat him with ease. With the arrogant, too, you can appear weaker than you are, taunting them into a rash action. Sun Bin, commander of the armies of Qi and loyal disciple of Sun Tzu, once led his troops against the armies of Wei, which outnumbered him 2-1. "Let us light 100,000 fires when our enemy enters Wei," suggested Sun Bin. 50,000 on the next day, and only 30,000 on the third. On the third day, the Wei general exclaimed,
I knew the men of Chi were cowards, and after only 3 days, more than half of them have deserted.
So, leaving behind his slow-moving, heavy infantry, the general decided to seize the moment and move swiftly on the Chi camp with a lightly armed force. Sun Bin's troops retreated, luring Wei's army into a narrow pass where they ambushed and destroyed them. With the Wei general dead and his forces decimated, Sun Bin now easily defeated the rest of his army. In the face of a hot-headed enemy, finally, an excellent response is no response. Follow the Talleyrand tactic. Nothing is as infuriating as a man who keeps his cool while others are losing theirs. If it will work to your advantage to unsettle people, affect the aristocratic, bored pose, neither mocking nor triumphant, but simply indifferent. This will light their fuse. When they embarrass themselves with a temper tantrum, you will have gained several victories, one of these being that in the face of their childishness, you have maintained your dignity and composure. Reversal. When playing with people's emotions, you have to be careful. Study the enemy beforehand. Some fish are best left at the bottom of the pond. The leaders of the city of Tyre, capital of ancient Phoenicia, felt confident they could withstand Alexander the Great, who had conquered the Orient but had not attacked their city, which stood well protected on the water. They sent ambassadors to Alexander, saying that although they would recognize him as emperor, they would not allow him or his forces to enter Tyre. This, of course, enraged him, and he immediately mounted a siege. For 4 months the city withstood him, and finally he decided that the struggle was not worth it, and that he would come to terms with the Tyrians. But they, feeling that they had already baited Alexander and gotten away with it, and confident that they could withstand him, refused to negotiate. In fact, they killed his messengers. This pushed Alexander over the edge. Now it didn't matter to him how long the siege lasted, or how large an army it needed. He had the resources and would do whatever it took. He remounted his assault so strenuously that he captured Tyre within days, burned it to the ground, and sold its people into slavery. You can bait the powerful and get them to commit and divide their forces, as Sun Bin did. But test the waters first. Find the gap in their strength. If there is no gap, if they are impossibly strong, you have nothing to gain and everything to lose by provoking them. Choose carefully whom you bait, and never stir up the sharks. Finally, there are times when a well-timed burst of anger can do you good. But your anger must be manufactured and under your control. Then you can determine exactly how and on whom it will fall. Never stir up reactions that will work against you in the long run. And use your thunderbolts rarely, to make them the more intimidating and meaningful. Whether purposefully staged or not, if your outbursts come too often, they will lose their power. Here are some further reflections on this law. From Chanoyu, the Japanese tea ceremony. Itakura Shigamune grinds his own tea. The Kyoto Shoshadai Itakura Sōnokami Shigamune was very fond of Chanoyu, the tea ceremony, and used to grind his own tea while sitting in the court as judge. And the reason was this. He once asked a friend of his, who was his companion in Chanoyu, a tea merchant named Eiki, to tell him frankly what was the public opinion about him. "Well," said Eiki, "they say that you get irritated with those who don't give their evidence very clearly and scold them. And so people are afraid to bring lawsuits before you, and if they do, the truth does not come out."
"Ah, I'm glad you have told me that," replied Shigamune. "For now that I consider it, I have fallen into the habit of speaking sharply to people in this way. And no doubt humble folk and those who are not ready in speech get flurried and are unable to put their case in the best light. I will see to it that this does not occur in the future." So after this, he had a tea mill placed before him in court, and in front of it the paper-covered shoji were drawn too. And Shigamune sat behind them and ground the tea, and thus kept his mind calm while he heard the cases. And he could easily see whether his composure was ruffled or not by looking at the tea, which would not fall evenly ground to the proper consistency if he got excited. And so justice was done impartially, and people went away from his court satisfied. From Arthur Schopenhauer,
If possible, no animosity should be felt for anyone. To speak angrily to a person, to show your hatred by what you say or by the way you look, is an unnecessary proceeding. Dangerous, foolish, ridiculous, and vulgar. Anger or hatred should never be shown, otherwise than in what you do. And feelings will be all the more effective in action insofar as you avoid the exhibition of them in any other way. It is only the cold-blooded animals whose bite is poisonous. From Fables by Jonathan Birch. The Monkey and the Wasp. A monkey, whilst munching a ripe pear, was pestered by the bare-faced importunities of a wasp, who nolens volens would have a part. After threatening the monkey with his anger, if he further hesitated to submit to his demand, he settled on the fruit, but was soon knocked off by the monkey. The irritable wasp now had recourse to invective, and after using the most insulting language, which the other calmly listened to, he so worked himself up into violent passion that, losing all consideration of the penalty, he flew to the face of the monkey, and stung him with such rage that he was unable to extricate his weapon, and was compelled to tear himself away, leaving it in the wound, thus entailing on himself a lingering death, accompanied by pains much greater than those he had inflicted. From Kinko, Essays in Idleness. Ditch High Priest. Kinyo, an officer of the second rank, had a brother called the High Priest Ryogaku, an extremely bad-tempered man. Next to his monastery grew a large nettle tree, which occasioned the nickname people gave him, the Nettle Tree High Priest. "That name is outrageous," said the High Priest, and cut down the tree. The stump still being left, people referred to him now as the Stump High Priest. More furious than ever, Ryogaku had the stump dug up and thrown away, but this left a big ditch. People now called him the Ditch High Priest. The 40th Law. Despise the free lunch. Judgment. What is offered for free is dangerous. It usually involves either a trick or a hidden obligation. What has worth is worth paying for. By paying your own way, you stay clear of gratitude, guilt, and deceit. It is also often wise to pay the full price. There is no cutting corners with excellence. Be lavish with your money and keep it circulating, for generosity is a sign and a magnet for power. Money and power. In the realm of power, everything must be judged by its cost, and everything has a price. What is offered for free or at bargain rates often comes with a psychological price tag, complicated feelings of obligation, compromises with quality, the insecurity those compromises bring, on and on. The powerful learn early to protect their most valuable resource, independence and room to maneuver. By paying the full price, they keep themselves free of dangerous entanglements and worries. Being open and flexible with money also teaches the value of strategic generosity, a variation on the old trick of giving when you are about to take. By giving the appropriate gift, you put the recipient under obligation. Generosity softens people up to be deceived. By gaining a reputation for liberality, you win people's admiration while distracting them from your power plays. By strategically spreading your wealth, you charm the other courtiers, creating pleasure and making valuable allies. Look at the masters of power, the Caesars, the Queen Elizabeths, the Michelangelos, the Medicis. Not a miser among them. Even the great con artists spend freely to swindle. Tight purse strings are unattractive. When engaged in seduction, Casanova would give completely not only of himself, but of his wallet. The powerful understand that money is psychologically charged, and that it is also a vessel of politeness and sociability. They make the human side of money a weapon in their armory. For everyone able to play with money, thousands more are locked in a self-destructive refusal to use money creatively and strategically. These types represent the opposite pole to the powerful, and you must learn to recognize them, either to avoid their poisonous natures or to turn their inflexibility to your advantage. The greedy fish. The greedy fish take the human side out of money. Cold and ruthless, they see only the lifeless balance sheet, viewing others solely as either pawns or obstructions in their pursuit of wealth. They trample on people's sentiments and alienate valuable allies. No one wants to work with the greedy fish, and over the years they end up isolated, which often proves their undoing. Greedy fish are the con artists' bread and butter. Lured by the bait of easy money, they swallow the ruse hook, line, and sinker. They are easy to deceive, for they spend so much time dealing with numbers, not with people, that they become blind to psychology, including their own. Either avoid them before they exploit you, or play on their greed to your gain. The bargain demon. Powerful people judge everything by what it costs, not just in money, but in time, dignity, and peace of mind. And this is exactly what bargain demons cannot do. Wasting valuable time digging for bargains, they worry endlessly about what they could have gotten elsewhere for a little less. On top of that, the bargain item they do buy is often shabby. Perhaps it needs costly repairs, or will have to be replaced twice as fast as a high-quality item. The cost of these pursuits, not always in money, though the price of a bargain is often deceptive, but in time and peace of mind, discourage normal people from undertaking them. But for the bargain demon, the bargain is an end in itself. These types might seem to harm only themselves, but their attitudes are contagious. Unless you resist them, they will infect you with the insecure feeling that you should have looked harder to find a cheaper price. Don't argue with them or try to change them. Just mentally add up the cost, in time and inner peace, if not in hidden financial expense, of the irrational pursuit of a bargain. The sadist. Financial sadists play vicious power games with money as a way of asserting their power. They might, for example, make you wait for money that is owed to you, promising you that the check is in the mail. Or if they hire you to work for them, they meddle in every aspect of the job, haggling and giving you ulcers. Sadists seem to think that paying for something gives them the right to torture and abuse the seller. They have no sense of the courtier element in money. If you are unlucky enough to get involved with this type, accepting a financial loss may be better in the long run than getting entangled in their destructive power games. The indiscriminate giver. Generosity has a definite function in power. It attracts people, softens them up, makes allies out of them. But it has to be used strategically, with a definite end in mind. Indiscriminate givers, on the other hand, are generous because they want to be loved and admired by all. And their generosity is so indiscriminate and needy that it may not have the desired effect. If they give to one and all, why should the recipient feel special? Attractive as it may seem to make an indiscriminate giver your mark, in any involvement with this type, you will often feel burdened by their insatiable emotional needs. Transgressions of the law. Transgression number one. After Francisco Pizarro conquered Peru in 1532, gold from the Incan Empire began to pour into Spain, and Spaniards of all classes started dreaming of the instant riches to be had in the New World. The story soon spread of an Indian chief to the east of Peru who once each year would ritually cover himself in gold dust and dive into a lake. Soon word of mouth transformed El Dorado, the golden man, into an empire called El Dorado, wealthier than the Incan, where the streets were paved and the buildings inlaid with gold. This elaboration of the story didn't seem implausible, for surely a chief who could afford to waste gold dust in a lake must rule a golden empire. Soon Spaniards were searching for El Dorado all over northern South America. In February of 1541, the largest expedition yet in this venture, led by Pizarro's brother Gonzalo, left Quito in Ecuador. Resplendent in their armors and colorful silks, 340 Spaniards headed east, along with 4,000 Indians to carry supplies and serve as scouts. 4,000 swine, dozens of llamas, and close to 1,000 dogs. But the expedition was soon hit by torrential rain, which rotted its gear and spoiled its food.
Meanwhile, as Gonzalo Pizarro questioned the Indians they met along the way, those who seemed to be withholding information, or who had not even heard of the fabulous kingdom, he would torture and feed to the dogs. Word of the Spaniards' murderousness spread quickly among the Indians, who realized that the only way to avoid Gonzalo's wrath was to make up stories about El Dorado and send him as far away as possible. As Gonzalo and his men followed the leads the Indians gave them then, they were only led farther into deep jungle. The explorers' spirits sagged. Their uniforms had long since shredded. Their armor rusted, and they threw it away. Their shoes were torn to pieces, forcing them to walk barefoot. The Indian slaves they had set out with had either died or deserted them. They had eaten not only the swine, but the hunting dogs and llamas. They lived on roots and fruit. Realizing that they could not continue this way, Pizarro decided to risk river travel, and a barge was built out of rotting wood. But the journey down the treacherous Napo River proved no easier. Setting up camp on the river's edge, Gonzalo sent scouts ahead on the barge to find Indian settlements with food. He waited and waited for the scouts to return, only to find out they had decided to desert the expedition and continue down the river on their own. The rain continued without end. Gonzalo's men forgot about El Dorado. They wanted only to return to Quito. Finally, in August of 1542, a little over 100 men, from an expedition originally numbering in the thousands, managed to find their way back. To the residents of Quito, they seemed to have emerged from hell itself, wrapped in tatters and skins, their bodies covered in sores, and so emaciated as to be unrecognizable. For over a year and a half, they had marched in an enormous circle, 2,000 miles by foot. The vast sums of money invested in the expedition had yielded nothing. No sign of El Dorado and no sign of gold. Interpretation. Even after Gonzalo Pizarro's disaster, the Spaniards launched expedition after expedition in search of El Dorado. And like Pizarro, the conquistadors would burn and loot villages, torture Indians, endure unimaginable hardships, and get no closer to gold. The money they spent on such expeditions cannot be calculated. Yet despite the futility of the search, the lure of the fantasy endured. Not only did the search for El Dorado cost millions of lives, both Indian and Spanish, it helped bring the ruin of the Spanish Empire. Gold became Spain's obsession. The gold that did find its way back to Spain, and a lot did, was reinvested in more expeditions, or in the purchase of luxuries, rather than in agriculture or any other productive endeavor. Whole Spanish towns were depopulated as their menfolk left to hunt gold. Farms fell into ruin, and the army had no recruits for its European wars. By the end of the 17th century, the entire country had shrunk by more than half of its population. The city of Madrid had gone from a population of 400,000 to 150,000. With diminishing returns from its efforts over so many years, Spain fell into a decline from which it never recovered. Power requires self-discipline. The power of wealth, particularly easy, sudden wealth, plays havoc with the emotions. The suddenly rich believe that more is always possible. The free lunch, the money that will fall into your lap, is just around the corner. In this delusion, the greedy neglect everything power really depends on. Self-control, the goodwill of others, and so on. Understand, with one exception, death, no lasting change in fortune comes quickly. Sudden wealth rarely lasts, for it is built on nothing solid. Never let lust for money lure you out of the protective and enduring fortress of real power. Make power your goal, and money will find its way to you. Leave El Dorado for suckers and fools. Transgression number two. In the early 18th century, no one stood higher in English society than the Duke and Duchess of Marlborough. The Duke, having led successful campaigns against the French, was considered Europe's premier general and strategist. And his wife, the Duchess, after much maneuvering, had established herself as the favorite of Queen Anne, who became ruler of England in 1702. In 1704, the Duke's triumph at the Battle of Blenheim made him the toast of England. and to honor him the queen awarded him a large plot of land in the town of Woodstock, and the funds to create a great palace there. Calling his planned home the Palace of Blenheim, the duke chose as his architect the young John Vanbrugh, a kind of Renaissance man who wrote plays as well as designed buildings. And so construction began in the summer of 1705 with much fanfare and great hopes. Vanbrugh had a dramatist's sense of architecture. His palace was to be a monument to Marlborough's brilliance and power, and was to include artificial lakes, enormous bridges, elaborate gardens, and other fantastical touches. From day one, however, the Duchess could not be pleased. She thought Vanbrugh was wasting money on yet another stand of trees. She wanted the palace finished as soon as possible. The Duchess tortured Vanbrugh and his workmen on every detail. She was consumed with petty matters. Although the government was paying for Blenheim, she counted every penny. Eventually, her grumbling about Blenheim and other things, too, created an irreparable rift between her and Queen Anne, who in 1711 dismissed her from the court, ordering her to vacate her apartments at the royal palace. When the Duchess left, fuming over the loss of her position and also of her royal salary, she emptied the apartment of every fixture down to the brass doorknobs. Over the next 10 years, work on Blenheim would stop and start as the funds became harder to procure from the government. The Duchess thought Vanbrugh was out to ruin her. She quibbled over every carload of stone and bushel of lime, counted every extra yard of iron railing or foot of wainscot, hurling abuse at the wasteful workmen, contractors, and surveyors. Marlborough, old and weary, wanted nothing more than to settle into the palace in his last years, but the project became bogged down in a swamp of litigation. The workmen suing the Duchess for wages, the Duchess suing the architect right back. In the midst of this interminable wrangling, the Duke died. He had never spent a night in his beloved Blenheim. After Marlborough's death, it became clear that he had a vast estate worth over £2 million, more than enough to pay for finishing the palace. But the Duchess would not relent. She held back Vanbrugh's wages as well as the workmen's, and finally had the architect dismissed. The man who took his place finished Blenheim in a few years, following Vanbrugh's designs to the letter. Vanbrugh died in 1726, locked out of the palace by the Duchess, unable to set foot in his greatest creation. Foreshadowing the Romantic movement, Blenheim had started a whole new trend in architecture, but had given its creator a 20-year nightmare. Interpretation. For the Duchess of Marlborough, money was the way to play sadistic power games. She saw the loss of money as a symbolic loss of power. With Vanbrugh, her contortions went deeper still. He was a great artist, and she envied his power to create, to attain fame outside her reach. She may not have had his gifts, but she did have the money to torture and abuse him over the pettiest details, to ruin his life. This kind of sadism, however, bears an awful price. It made construction that should have lasted 10 years take 20. It poisoned many a relationship, alienated the Duchess from the court, deeply pained the Duke, who wanted only to live peacefully at Blenheim, created endless lawsuits, and took years off Vanbrugh's life. Finally, too, posterity had the last word. Vanbrugh is recognized as a genius, while the Duchess is forever remembered for her consummate cheapness. The powerful must have grandeur of spirit. They can never reveal any pettiness. And money is the most visible arena in which to display either grandeur or pettiness. Best spend freely, then, and create a reputation for generosity, which in the end will pay great dividends. Never let financial details blind you to the big picture of how people perceive you. Their resentment will cost you in the long run. And if you want to meddle in the work of creative people under your hire, at least pay them well. Your money will buy their submission better than your displays of power. Observances of the Law. Observance number one. Pietro Aretino, son of a lowly shoemaker, had catapulted himself into fame as a writer of biting satires. But like every Renaissance artist, he needed to find a patron who would give him a comfortable lifestyle while not interfering with his work. In 1528, Aretino decided to attempt a new strategy in the patronage game. Leaving Rome, he established himself in Venice, where few had heard of him. He had a fair amount of money he had managed to save, but little else. Soon after he moved into his new home, however, he threw open its doors to rich and poor, regaling them with banquets and amusements. He befriended each and every gondolier, tipping them royally. In the streets he spread his money liberally, giving it away to beggars, orphans, washerwomen. Among the city's commoners, word quickly spread that Aretino was more than just a great writer. He was a man of power, a kind of lord. Artists and men of influence soon began to frequent Aretino's house. Within a few years, he had made himself a celebrity. No visiting dignitary would think of leaving Venice without paying him a call. His generosity had cost him most of his savings, but had brought him influence and a good name, a cornerstone in the foundation of power. Since in Renaissance Italy, as elsewhere, the ability to spend freely was the privilege of the rich, the aristocracy thought Aretino had to be a man of influence, since he spent money like one. And since the influence of a man of influence is worth buying, Aretino became the recipient of all sorts of gifts and monies. Dukes and duchesses, wealthy merchants, and popes and princesses competed to gain his favor, and showered him with all kinds of presents. Aretino's spending habits, of course, were strategic, and the strategy worked like a charm. But for real money and comfort, he needed a great patron's bottomless pockets. Having surveyed the possibilities, he eventually set his sights on the extremely wealthy Marquis of Mantua, and wrote an epic poem that he dedicated to the Marquis. This was a common practice of writers looking for patronage. In exchange for a dedication, they would get a small stipend, enough to write yet another poem. So that they spent their lives in a kind of constant servility. Aretino, however, wanted power, not a measly wage. He might dedicate a poem to the Marquis, but he would offer it to him as a gift, implying by doing so that he was not a hired hack looking for a stipend, but that he and the Marquis were equals. Aretino's gift-giving didn't stop there. As a close friend of two of Venice's greatest artists, the sculptor Jacopo Sansovino and the painter Titian, he convinced these men to participate in his gift-giving scheme. Aretino had studied the Marquis before going to work on him, and knew his taste inside and out. He was able to advise Sansovino and Titian what subject matter would please the Marquis most. When he then sent a Sansovino sculpture and a Titian painting to the Marquis as gifts from all three of them, the man was beside himself with joy. Over the next few months, Aretino sent other gifts, swords, saddles, the glass that was a Venetian specialty, things he knew the Marquis prized. Soon he, Titian, and Sansovino began to receive gifts from the Marquis in return. And the strategy went further. When the son-in-law of a friend of Aretino's found himself in jail in Mantua, Aretino was able to get the Marquis to arrange his release. Aretino's friend, a wealthy merchant, was a man of great influence in Venice. By turning the goodwill he had built up with the Marquis to use, Aretino had now bought this man's indebtedness too, and he in turn would help Aretino when he could. The circle of influence was growing wider. Time and again Aretino was able to cash in on the immense political power of the Marquis, who also helped him in his many court romances. Eventually, however, the relationship became strained, as Aretino came to feel that the Marquis should have requited his generosity better. But he would not lower himself to begging or whining. Since the exchange of gifts between the two men had made them equals, it would not seem right to bring up money. He simply withdrew from the Marquis's circle and hunted for other wealthy prey, settling first on the French King Francis, then the Medicis, the Duke of Urbino, Emperor Charles V, and more. In the end, having many patrons meant he didn't have to bow to any of them, and his power seemed comparable to that of a great lord. Interpretation. Aretino understood two fundamental properties of money. First, that it has to circulate to bring power. What money should buy is not lifeless objects, but power over people. By keeping money in constant circulation, Aretino bought an ever-expanding circle of influence that in the end more than compensated him for his expenses. Second, Aretino understood the key property of a gift. To give a gift is to imply that you and the recipient are equals at the very least, or that you are the recipient's superior. A gift also involves an indebtedness or obligation. When friends, for instance, offer you something for free, you can be sure they expect something in return, and that to get it, they are making you feel indebted. The mechanism may or may not be entirely conscious on their part, but this is how it works. Aretino avoided such encumbrances on his freedom. Instead of acting like a menial who expects the powerful to pay his way in life, he turned the whole dynamic around. Instead of being indebted to the powerful, he made the powerful indebted to him. This was the point of his gift-giving, a ladder that carried him to the highest social levels. By the end of his life, he had become the most famous writer in Europe. Understand, money may determine power relationships, but those relationships need not depend on the amount of money you have. They also depend on the way you use it. Powerful people give freely, buying influence rather than things. If you accept the inferior position because you have no fortune yet, you may find yourself in it forever. Play the trick that Aretino played on Italy's aristocracy. Imagine yourself an equal. Play the Lord, give freely, open your doors, circulate your money, and create the facade of power through the alchemy that transforms money into influence. Observance number 2. Soon after Baron James Rothschild made his fortune in Paris in the early 1820s, he faced his most intractable problem. How could a Jew and a German, a total outsider to French society, win the respect of the xenophobic French upper classes? Rothschild was a man who understood power. He knew that his fortune would bring him status, but that if he remained socially alienated, neither his status nor his fortune would last. So he looked at the society of the time and asked what would win their hearts. Charity? The French couldn't care less. Political influence? He already had that, and if anything, it only made people more suspicious of him. The one weak spot, he decided, was boredom. In the period of the restoration of the monarchy, the French upper classes were bored. So Rothschild began to spend astounding sums of money on entertaining them. He hired the best architects in France to design his gardens and ballroom. He hired Marie-Antoine Carême, the most celebrated French chef, to prepare the most lavish parties Paris had ever witnessed. No Frenchman could resist, even if the parties were given by a German Jew. Rothschild's weekly soirees began to attract bigger and bigger numbers. Over the next few years, he won the only thing that would secure an outsider's power, social acceptance. Interpretation. Strategic generosity is always a great weapon in building a support base, particularly for the outsider. But the Baron de Rothschild was cleverer still. He knew it was his money that had created the barrier between him and the French, making him look ugly and untrustworthy. The best way to overcome this was literally to waste huge sums, a gesture to show he valued French culture and society over money. What Rothschild did resembled the famous potlatch feasts of the American Northwest. By periodically destroying its wealth in a giant orgy of festivals and bonfires, an Indian tribe would symbolize its power over other tribes. The base of its power was not money, but its ability to spend, and its confidence in a superiority that would restore to it all that the potlatch had destroyed. In the end, the Baron's soirees reflected his desire to mingle not just in France's business world, but in its society. By wasting money on his potlatches, he hoped to demonstrate that his power went beyond money into the more precious realm of culture. Rothschild may have won social acceptance by spending money, but the support base he gained was one that money alone couldn't buy. To secure his fortune, he had to waste it. That is strategic generosity in a nutshell. The ability to be flexible with your wealth, putting it to work, not to buy objects, but to win people's hearts. Observance number 3. The Medicis of Renaissance Florence had built their immense power on the fortune they had made in banking. But in Florence, centuries-old republic that it was, the idea that money bought power went against all the city's proud democratic values. Cosimo de' Medici, the first of the family to gain great fame, worked around this by keeping a low profile. He never flaunted his wealth. but by the time his grandson Lorenzo came of age, in the 1470s, the family's wealth was too large and their influence too noticeable to be disguised any longer. Lorenzo solved the problem.